Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.
Stuart Lancaster, thanks very much for sitting down with us. There's a couple of things that I'm very interested in talking to you about and getting into some detail about. One is how your teams play. What is your philosophy? What are your teams trying to do when they have the ball and when they don't have the ball? And then the other thing is, how do you actually go about making sure that the young players who come in, particularly this time of year, are actually able to do the same job as the senior players who are off in the international team? Granted, there's going to be some difference in their proficiency because they're not with the senior international team. Yeah. But maybe we can start with the first one. How do your teams play rugby?
Well, I guess we talk about without the ball to start with. Because I guess when I came to Leinster, the priority for me was get defensive solidity and make sure we're hard to beat. So I think we work very hard on defence, particularly in the lead up to the really big games. You know, I would say that becomes the sort of overriding priority. So we make sure that everyone, one, understands the defensive system. Now, there's lots of different defensive systems out there that you can employ. And I obviously have got my own philosophy and my own beliefs, which has come about from working with other defence coaches, seeing other defence coaches studying the game, trying to work out where the trends in the game are going. So we make sure everyone understands the system, clearly. It's pretty black and white, really. There's elements of grey in there. Obviously, there's decision-making, but we need to make sure how we understand from kicks, from restarts, from scrums, from line-outs, who's doing what role. The philosophy of our defence, and then ultimately we then need to get the mentality of our defence right. So you get the philosophy right and then the mentality. So you get the system right, get the philosophy right, get the mentality right, and then you drill it in training so it becomes unconscious. So they can defend repeated sets and not make errors, which ultimately result in line breaks or tries. So that's how it's sort of layered together, if you like. That's how I sort of go about building it. And
are you happy to tell us what your defensive system is?
I don't think it's rocket science. I don't want to go into too much detail because it does give a lot away. But essentially, there's different defensive systems. So if I take Wales at the weekend, for example, they typically play with Lee Halfpenny in the backfield, with the wingers high, as in like connected to the centres or to the edge defence, and nines in the line. So there you call that a 14-1 defence. Some teams would have maybe the open side winger sat off, the fullback in the backfield, everyone else in the front line. You know, you describe that as a sort of a 13-2 or even like a 12-half. You know, it's a winger sat off. So we typically have two in the backfield, and then we'd have a full front line. But it's not quite as simple as that because the two in the backfield varies depending on the scenario. And how many you have in the front line depends on how many you put into the defensive ruck, and et cetera, et cetera.
Who makes those decisions about how you resource the ruck? And does that change from game to game?
Yeah, it does change from game to game, but I give them a framework, basically, in defence and say, these are the parameters and these are the decisions you need to make, and we need to make more good decisions than bad decisions. So, you know, for example, if you're saying, right, we're going to put... there's a tackle made and we're going to put two into every ruck or three into every ruck, then you're going to be compromised somewhere else. You might turn the ball over, but equally you might be vulnerable on the edges. So ultimately what we're trying to create is a good spread of defenders across the field in a straight line with good space in between them, which means then we can go up square and straight. And then if they move the ball to the outside of us, we can move up and out, or sometimes we can come up and in, but being straight and square is the fundamental key. If you put three into the ruck, for example, then you get your backfield wrong, you put three in the backfield, then you're going to have less than the front line, so you'll have to be a little bit tighter, and you have to be up and out, which means you might concede space on the edge. So it's all about understanding your backfield, your decision-making at the ruck, your spacing, and the ability to get square off the line.
Are you allowing the defenders to have some instinct about when to resource the ruck and when not to?
Yeah. So we say to them, you know, we need to make good decisions at the ruck. And, you know, I will constantly review in training or in games. This is a really good decision, Josh van der Flier. You've gone on the ball. It's an opportunity to turn the ball over. We've turned the ball over. We've got the ball back. Perfect. Or here's a guy, Josh van der Flier, putting your head into the ruck when you're not going to win the ball. You've now compromised our defensive system, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that education is part of the defensive system. But I have to say, I stress really that That's one part, but the big part really is the desire to want to defend and the mentality to defend. I think often in teams you see teams who are either too attack-minded and not defence-minded, or vice versa. And I guess because I coach on both sides of the ball, you know, attack and defence, I always try and create an equilibrium in both, the importance of both in the mind's eye of the player.
Yeah, we've spoken a bit about this before, but that's quite unusual in rugby. Most teams have a defence coach and most teams have an attack coach.
Yeah.
I don't know why that happened, but it just did happen. It evolved that way. Do you see it maybe trending back towards the direction where somebody has responsibility for both, given that this isn't a game where there's a stop and start? This isn't American football where when one team has the ball, the other team doesn't have the ball. The turnover happens so quickly.
Yeah, I think probably the trend is maybe more towards a head coach, a backs coach and a forwards coach, which means the head coach has to coach attack and defence, which is pretty much the model we have here. You know, I'll be the senior coach responsible for attack and defence, Leo's the head coach or the director of rugby, you know, he'd look after the bigger picture and everything else, and then Felipe does the backs and Robbie McBride does the forwards. That's the way the model's emerged here. Now, typically when you're developing as a coach in rugby, you tend to specialise in one area over another. And I guess because I had a really broad development as a coach through teaching, through academy. You know, I ran an academy in Leeds basically from 2000 to 2005 where I was on my own with, you know, 30, 40 talented players. So you have to coach both sides of the ball because there's only you doing it, really.
Yeah.
So you learn. And then, you know, obviously we've talked about this before, I've gravitated into other different roles, you know, through my time. But then I come back at Leinster and I immediately go back to all that learning I took place in my formative years as a coach. And I think it is quite rare, but I think, you know, there are other teams emerging with the same sort of model. But it does require that coach to have an understanding of both sides, so you've got to study both sides.
Yeah, and look, it makes sense that you study both sides. If you want to be a really good defender, you need to know what the best attacks are doing in the world. Just to go back to the defensive structure and the setup, when you're watching other defences, are you stealing from them on a weekly basis? Are you going, I like a little bit of that, I'm going to have some of that? Or are you like, actually, I see what you're doing there and I'm only looking at that from an attacking perspective? Like, is your defensive system finished? Is kind of what I'm asking.
No, I don't think it's ever finished. I don't think it's even remotely close to ever being finished. I think it's constantly evolving. You're constantly learning. The system doesn't change too much. You know, obviously we've adapted and we change our defence off set piece. Sometimes to play at Saracens or Munster, you know, you might change how you defend off set piece differently. Your overall system probably won't change too much in the season, because if it does, the players start then getting confused and, you know, there's lots of grey areas emerge and then doubts creep in, and suddenly your credibility has been eroded a little bit as a defence coach because you've started to change your philosophy. One of the key things that I've said many times to coaches is be clear on your philosophy before you start the season. Don't start changing it halfway through the season. So it is clear in my mind before we start. We adapt as we go and we learn as we go, but there's an element of repetition as well, of making sure we repeat movement patterns that are going to happen in the game, and we drill them so it becomes deep in their subconscious, you know, about this is how we defend. So in the 78th minute, you know, we can trust that the guy to our left and the guy to our right are going to do certain things, irrespective of who those people are, because in rugby, it's such a chaotic game that there's going to be people all over the place. We all have to be able to buy into that system. So, I think there's a lot of stability in the system, which I think is important, but there's decisions that still have to be made in it.
Yeah, I get the stability is kind of the architecture you build everything off, but obviously the game evolves and changes. There's been a suggestion that the Saracens defence in recent years has been one that a lot of teams have tried to ape because they had a specific set of personnel who were able to do something and put pressure on the opposition again and again and again. Was there something specific about that defence that was very good? Was that a global trend?
And I think people like Andy Farrell, for sure, who was at Saracens at the time, Paul Gustard, who was at Saracens at the time, you know, they deserve a huge amount of credit. Andy, particularly, you know, he was the one who, when I was coaching England Saxons, he worked with me in 2009, and I said to him, can you look after defence? And he came with this philosophy that, you know, he was part him, but part he'd learned from Rugby League, and, you know, that's had a big influence on defences in Rugby Union, you know, Rugby League coaching. I think Saracens were ahead of the game, for sure. And I think that's what gave them a lot of their strength. They played a very position-based game as well. So they would talk a lot about territory and not waste energy in their own half. So they would box kick a lot and they would try and play a territory game and then trust their defence. And they'd call it try-scoring defence, where you know their defence would fill the front line and then they'd force an error through relentless defensive pressure. They'd pick the ball up and run the ball, score a try. Bingo. Our try-scoring defence. And there's no doubt that, you know, Exeter, when I look at Exeter and Saracens and the top English clubs, there's a big similarity with how they're all defending now. Even to the extent now when I watch Crusaders play in Super Rugby, you know, speaking to Rog, and there's principles that he took from the Northern Hemisphere down into New Zealand. And I see that when I watch Crusaders play. So all the top teams are reasonably similar. When I'm looking at defences with the teams, of course, I'm looking for trends and I'm looking for examples of great defence, and I'll show them to our players. But I'm also looking for weaknesses in defensive systems as well. And when you coach defence a lot and you've been burnt and you've conceded tries, you learn to spot the weaknesses better because you're attuned to them, you know. So for example, we've got a game this weekend. The first thing I would look at is the wide view of the game. I won't look at the tight view, the wide view of the game. What is their defensive system? Where are the moving parts? Where are the weaknesses in the defence? How can we exploit them? And then I'm back into attack mode then.
Do you get the wide view from all their games? Is that all the coaching staffs get the same access to the same? Okay, that's just part of the, it's a great idea. Because at some point they should make that available to everybody, because then we'd all be able to see it. And then I think...
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, if there's a magic wand I could wave, it would be to improve the quality of analysis that gets done so that the, you know, a rugby fan, a rugby supporter can really understand the game. I actually think it's done really well in Ireland. And I'm not saying that because I'm here, but I do think some of the analysis you see online, I'm going, yeah, I agree with that. I can see what they're saying here. And I think that form of expert opinion to inform the armchair viewer can only be helpful.
Yeah.
But sometimes with punditry as well, you don't see that, and you see them talking about the wrong things, and you're like, you know, you're waving your hands in the air, but equally, I get it. You know, it's not everyone's going to be a student of the game. Some people are just armchair viewers who just want to enjoy the game. Let's not get too technical.
There's definitely a balance to be struck. Last question on defence then. Is your defence significantly different from the Saracen-style defence that has become predominant in England at the moment?
Not hugely. I'd say there'd be a lot more similarities than differences. We'd have certain differences. And that's a challenge when you play Saracens. You know, I understand their system pretty well, but you've still got to break it down.
Yeah.
And you know, on any given day, you know, 2 years ago we broke it down and we won in the quarterfinal. In the final, you know, 10-0 up, and opportunities we created as well in the second half. You know, we thought we had opportunities to break it down. That was a frustration in the final, that we didn't actually put the nail in the coffin when we had the chance.
So in Gaelic football at the moment, the Dublin football team are the predominant, most talented, and have the best system. And if I was a GAA coach, I would be obsessed with beating them because they are the best.
Yeah.
Are Saracens a little bit like that for you when you're watching them going, whatever we do in all the games throughout the year, we know that we're going to come up against them at some point and we're going to have to win that game. So when you are doing your conditioning the mind to behave in certain ways, is it with the express intention of a couple of key, maybe not just them, but a couple of other key games?
Yeah, I would say not just them. I think you'd be doing, you know, Exeter or like Toulouse, for example. You take Toulouse last year, I mean, you look at France this year, you know, it's no coincidence that France are going well because suddenly the Toulouse players have been promoted, and DuPont and these guys are amazing. So I'm watching Toulouse last year in our pool thinking, this is an unbelievable attacking team here. We need to be absolutely red hot on defence. And they play a completely different offloading freestyle of rugby that no other team in the Northern Hemisphere was playing. So the whole week leading to the Toulouse game, both home, the away game, the home game, and then we play them again, if you remember, in the semi-final. We were absolutely on point defensively because they could attack and strike from anywhere. So part of obviously being good defensively is not giving the ball back cheaply and not kicking to them and not offloading the ball at stupid times and giving them more opportunities to attack against you, because if you switch off for 1 second against the side of the quality of Toulouse, then you can concede tries. And that was why the most pleasing performances of last season for me that still stick in my mind were the Toulouse defensive performances, particularly not the one away from home, we gave an intercept, but the ones at home at the IDS when we had some senior players injured and we held them to one try. And then the semi-final, I don't think they scored a try, which is remarkable, really. So there's a real... But as I say, I can't emphasize the point enough. If you have to really want to defend, you know, and you have to... And part of the reason, the advantage of a defensive coach is, being a defensive coach, is that you care about it. And when you concede a try, even if you're winning by 50 points, it should still matter. And if your mindset doesn't drive that in your team, then you failed, I think, as a coach.
So is that something that you can coach as well? I mean, obviously, I think you seem to be somebody who believes that everything is coachable, really. Everybody is teachable. All physical aspects are teachable, mental aspects are teachable. So presumably, you can teach mindset. You can get better at that type of thing.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, particularly sport like rugby, where an emotional commitment to the game is important, you know, that sense of how can we have a pride in our defence and our performance on a weekly basis. How can I show examples of great defence, winning matches? And you only have to look, you know, I think, you know, I've given presentations in the past to players or explanations to players where typically the team that wins the title is the team that concedes the least amount of tries or goals or whatever it is. You know, look at, I found a great clip from Liverpool, the assistant coach, talking about their intensity. Their intensity is their identity. When we lose the ball, we go and get the ball back. It's our ball. That's the way he described it. Pep Linders, I think it's called. It's a brilliant YouTube clip. It's worth watching. He described, and look at Liverpool at the moment. They're absolutely flying because they have a real passion to want to get the ball back. It's our ball.
Yeah.
And so you can give that as an example. You can give, I don't know, any team who really care about it, you can show examples and bring it to life for the players. And yeah, of course you can coach it. But if you as a coach, you don't passionately enjoy believing it, want to instill it in your players, they'll commit to it, but not 100%, and that ultimately can be the difference.
Yeah, well, it has to be their identity. They're going to live it out under extreme duress at some point during the season. Yeah. It's interesting that we've talked this much about defence, but actually it's the attacking flair that Leinster have and that have traditionally had that this team has inherited that mantle of being one of the best attacking teams in Europe. It's clearly, for you, built off being a great defence, though.
Yeah, it's both. It is both. It is, but it's not. It's, but you know, like I said, when I first came in, the first thing I wanted to improve was the defence, because we'd lost. We'd only won one game in Europe. We lost against Connacht in the final. Connacht were playing great attacking rugby at the time. I remember analysing that game, going, "What was the defensive system here?" You know, and we played Connacht that next year, and we were still playing under Pat and playing great rugby, but we made their attacking system their biggest weakness. You know, that was the mentality I was trying to put. So for the first period of time at Leinster, that was very much my mindset. But also in the back of my mind was wanting to sort of build on what was already a very strong identity of an attacking framework built on great players, great coaches, good set piece, you know, organisation, and just needed tweaking rather than the defensive system, which needed probably changing.
So what's your attacking philosophy?
I'd say it's to score tries in as many different ways as possible, to have the ability to score tries in many different ways as possible. I was actually thinking about doing this the other day, and I mentioned to the analysts about whether we could come up with 10 tries that Leinster scored in different ways. And you know, I was doing a presentation actually at DCU on talent development. I think freedom with responsibility would be probably another phrase. So we have the freedom to play what we see. And you know, I've talked about in the past, you know, making sure we can be very good at the unstructured part of the game, but that's not to give the notion that there is no structure in our unstructured rugby. There is structure, there is a framework that we allow the players to play with, and then there's flexibility within that freedom with responsibility within the framework. So you can't break down modern defences by just being chaotic and players can do what they want. Defences are too organised. So you have to have a system and a strategy to break down modern defences. A Saracens defence, a 13-2 defence, a 14-1 defence. Some of it involves kicking. Some of it involves playing the backfield. Some of it involves pressure rugby. You know, i.e. you put the ball in the corners, they kick the ball out, you drive a maul, you score a try, you pick and go, you score a try. So I think, certainly my first year, we talked about what Leinster rugby meant. And, you know, you go back through the great Leinster performances and the ones I saw when I was in England at the time, you know, Northampton games and stick in my mind. And there'll be a lot more beside that. So you've got this sort of Leinster rugby, and we play that brand in the first year, but yet we lose against Scarlets and Claremont in two semi-finals. And the Scarlets game is the one that really stuck in my mind, but also the one that probably helped us evolve more so, because they had a player sent off early in the game, so we were playing against 14, and you know, on any given day, Leinster playing against 14 would win, and we lost. And they pretty much stacked the front line, they only had one in the backfield. And we weren't as cohesive as we needed to be, for whatever reason, you know, we weren't quite... And sometimes it happens. Sometimes the way the referees a breakdown, sometimes the weather, sometimes for whatever reason. But you've still got to find a way to win. Mm. And we coined this phrase, pressure rugby. So kick the corners, force them to kick out, build pressure, score a different way. And we didn't do that. So we said we need to be able to be adaptable to play a Leinster rugby or pressure rugby. And sometimes we need to do it in the same game. So, for example, we're sat here, you know, a day before potentially Storm Dennis comes and whacks itself into Ireland, and we're playing the Cheetahs, and we might have to play pressure rugby the weekend and win that way. So that's probably the best way to describe it. The sexy bit is the bit, obviously, the free-flowing, offloading, multi-phase rugby. But that'd be, it'd be lying to say that that's the only way we score.
Yeah. The pressure game, I think everybody understands. It's rugby that we've all seen, particularly Six Nations rugby this time of year. The bit where people do get excited is as we begin to see these brilliant players reach their full potential. And in an Irish sense, we're obsessed with offloads and like seeing offloads and our players running on to offloads. How have you become good at that as a team? What is that something that you do practice as well?
Yeah.
How do you practice that even?
Well, I think the how you do it is so you give them a framework, so some basic phase play shapes and calls to coordinate the backs and forwards in simple language. And then what you do is you then create a variety of different games in training that allow them to practice. So I'll give you an example. We had Tuesday's training session, and the first game we played was double touch. So if you're touched by one person, you can keep on running. And if you're touched by a second person, then you have to go down and present the ball, and then we can move the ball away. So what that means is you're always looking for one-on-ones. You get touched by one person, you keep on running. As soon as you've broken the line, the person who's been touched, you can't score, so you have to pass to someone else. So you encourage you in support play. So we played double touch for a while. Then we went to double touch with an offload. So if you're double touched, but then you can still offload the ball away, then that encourages the offload and you keep the ball alive and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Then we went to lift touch, where if you're touched, you lift the ball between the legs and it creates super quick ball, like quicker than the game would be. So the ball just constantly zips around and you're always on top of the defence. And then we went to 15 on 15, where we made it a little bit more realistic. And so I'm constantly, the way that training is formulated is there's a balance of core skill repetition, technique repetition on passing and catching and line running within the session, interspersed with decision-making games run at high speed, where it's mentally, physically and emotionally challenging, where I'm trying to ingrain the movement patterns and habits in the players so they become unconscious. So that regardless of who's playing for Leinster or who's playing in any given team, and I'm constantly changing the teams, then you see cohesion and you see that there's a flow to it. You know, there's a synergy to it, so that everyone knows what they're doing at any individual point in time. And then that becomes very hard to defend, very hard to control as a defensive team. And the other thing is you make sure you don't stop the session every time to correct. Mm. You know, I would do corrections in the session, or I would review afterwards and give them the corrections, but I wouldn't stop the flow of the session. So
you might have a word with an individual in the middle as opposed to saying, yeah, okay, well, everybody stop.
Yeah,
now.
Exactly. So I'd be very big. I'd be a big believer on the way in which you create high performance is through training. You know, I think a lot of coaches would probably say yes, training's part of it, but equally what we do, or what we say before the game, or what we do before the game. You know, I think it's done at the start of the week, and I think the sessions that you do, you can ingrain those habits in the players. And what happens is the players become instinctive, they become aware of each other's lines of running, and they begin to see the movement patterns, they begin to see, you know, the decisions they have to make before they have to happen. Their anticipation grows, their mental quickness and alertness grows, and so you form a team that's hard to defend.
It's a virtuous circle. How much time is spent in the classroom? Because that's one of the things that's you know, has been an issue in Irish rugby. Recently, apparently, even the change in training facilities, the classroom is here, the pitch is right there, they can walk in, do some stuff, walk back in, do some classroom work. It's more symbiotic.
Yeah,
what's the situation here?
No, I'd say we do a fair amount of, if you call it, classroom learning. So a typical start of a week, so you'd be reviewing the game from the weekend, classroom. You'd talk about what we learned, what we did well, what can we do better next time.
How long is that session?
30 minutes.
Right, that's quick.
But equally, it's not just me going, right, sometimes I'll go, right, okay, everyone just have a conversation with the person beside you. And just rate our attack, defence, set piece and mindset out of a scale of 1 to 10. And tell me why. You know. So I'll try and get some feedback from the group. I'll try and engage them in their views before I give, you know, the sort of coaching view.
Yeah.
And then I'll pick typically maybe 10 minutes total of clips. Some attack, some defence. It's usually in chronological order of the game because obviously decisions that get made in the game are affected by what the score is, how long there is to go, etc., etc. And then the players would then split into either a conditioning session, and the backs would do a unit session, unit review with Felipe. His might be more about the backs plays, and he's probably then turning the page to the next team anyway. He'll pick up individuals. Robin McBride would do the same with the scrums and the lineouts. And then in the afternoon, we probably preview very quickly the opposition, but then we're training. And within the conditioning sessions as well, probably one of the advantages of this facility is that the conditioning space has also space to do skills in there. So we can do a lot of rehearsal of movement patterns, but just walking through it, walking through lineups, walking through plays, walking through. Or we can do weights and skills, so we can do some hand-eye coordination or whatever. So you're always integrated. And again, this facility is great because you've got a meeting room, a conditioning room, and a pitch.
All in one,
which is exactly what I think. I've not been to the new place in Ireland, but where Andy's taken them, but I think that's what they've got there, which has gone to their advantage. It has to be.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it definitely sounds like they're enjoying it a good bit more as well.
Yeah.
That confidence in your own team's attacking ability, does that mean you actually think less about what the opposition defence are going to do, even though we've already talked about like keeping an eye on what...
Yeah, I mean, so I'd want to know their trends in defence and their defensive systems, and I'd want to show the players examples of where I think we can challenge them. But I'm definitely more on, let's get our bit right.
Right.
If we train with maximum intensity, freedom with responsibility, good decision-making games, repetition of movement patterns and skill execution, with the quality of players we have and the cohesion that we can create, we're going to be hard to stop. You know, and I guess, you know, we've scored over 90 tries in the Pro 14 in the last 3 years. We've scored the most tries in Europe. So we're doing something right, but they're not all lengths to rugby tries.
No.
It's that balance of sometimes it's the power game, sometimes the pick and go game, sometimes it's the turnover, sometimes it's the defence game. So it's the totality of the picture, I think, that makes it.
Recently, just occasionally in conversation with Ronan O'Gara on the radio, he'll slip in bits about like trying to move the opposition defenders just a couple of yards to get a bit of space, and it sounds very American football. It's like, I see that they have somebody, the backfield is in the wrong position. It sounds like you guys do a little bit less of that, or maybe you do that kind of on a more micro level with the out halves or the number eight or whoever's going to be moving.
It's not with basically you've got a defensive line in front of you who are all trying to hold 2 meter spaces. in essence. So what you're trying to do when you're running your tackle line, let's say you're about half and you go into the line and you're fixing that defender and you're running straight at him, and then the next guy who's maybe could get the ball but might not get the ball is going to run a tight line, and that defender's going to come in 1 metre, which now means the gap between him and the inside defender is 1 metre, but that now is a 3 metre gap on the outside of him. It's those micro movements and the quality of the lines, the quality of the out half to take the ball square to the lines. It means you as a defender, you're not moving anywhere because you need to defend me. But then the lines of everyone else are of sufficient quality, and the timing of those creates those slight doubts in defenders' minds, and then suddenly you've got a Robbie Henshaw out the back or Jordan Lama using good feet. This defender is now struggling to make a two-man tackle, and he's through the line, and you're off and playing.
So you walk through that slowly, and then you practice
well,
the movement.
Well, in the infancy of developing it in any team, that's what you'd do. But at Leinster now, you know, I would like to think we don't have to walk through this. They know the detail. I repeat it time and time again, the basic movement patterns. It's a bit like, take the basketball analogy, you know, you would practice your layups, you practice your free shots, you know, but within that then also you've got the movement patterns of the basketball team.
Yeah.
It's the same principle where you're working on both elements concurrently.
How do you keep that fresh then? You talked about repeating it. That's the other challenge for all coaches, is that your voice won't be fresh every day you come in, because it can't be, So what do you do to make sure that still lands and that message still lands?
I think it is. I think it's repetition with variety, if that makes sense. So it's repeating the same messages in different ways, in different games, in different drills, but not so... So there's a school of thought and this happened in England, a school of thought that we need to create a really chaotic environment for the players where we can pass the ball in any direction, we can use lots of different shaped balls, and we're going to create this really, you know, creative group of players. So if that is completely unstructured, and this is completely structured here, where all we're going to do, we're going to talk about our lineups and our scrums and our launch plays, and, you know, if there's two extremes there, I'd probably sit in the middle. But this school of thought happened over here for a while, and I kept thinking, this is just too... There's not enough detail here. The technique of playing the ball, catching the ball, running straight out of line, fixing the defender, running good lines, because modern defences are too well organised. You just don't break them down like you used to be able to. So you have to be really subtle in the way you do it. And so you need that element of repetition. And I say this to coaches, you need the variety in your locker. Have you got the variety in your locker? So I see a lot of players who've been players going to coaching, and they might repeat a few drills that the old coach used to do. And then, you know, maybe 3 weeks into pre-season, and they're thinking, I've got 45 weeks to go now, three sessions a week. I'm not really sure I've got many other games in my locker now that I can play. And, you know, it's a challenge. You know, I've probably lucky in the old 10,000-hour rule. I've had 10,000 hours of coaching, therefore I've got 10,000 hours of drills somewhere locked away, either written down or in my head. Or if they're not there, then I will spend the majority of my Monday night before Tuesday on my own thinking about how can I create the drills or the games I want in today's training session to deliver. You know, and I need to know how many numbers are training. You know, is it, have we got 45 training, which we've got three teams of 15? Is it 32 training? Is it, you know, however many is training? What size pitch do I want? What are the parameters of the game I want to play? Why? It's funny because I put all this thought into it, and then the players just turn up and then, right, what we're doing today, coach? And what I found actually works really well is then I explain, because for a while I think they just thought I was just like coming up with crazy stuff. And I've started now more often in the last year and a half really sitting down explaining, right, we've got 30-odd training. We're going to play this size pitch. We're going to play with these parameters. What do you think the outcome I'm looking for is? Because I'm trying not to tell them the outcome, because I'm trying to let them problem solve in the game. But equally, I need them to have some sort of understanding about the thought that's gone into it. And I've got this, let's say... the difference between this job, and we've talked about this, you know, with the England job, is the England job, I'm thinking about leadership stuff and managerial stuff and managing selection and managing this and managing that. Whereas here, I'm thinking about how can I come up with the most creative coaching session that's not so creative that it's off the wall that means we're not going to play good Leinster rugby.
But I think the obvious thing to do would be to tell them, okay, today's training session we're going to do this, this and this because we want you to get to this. But actually asking them, why do you think I'm doing this?
Exactly. Because
it's quite a transformative moment for...
Yeah, it is. Because ultimately, you know, you can't be there on the field to help them solve in the game anyway. So they have to problem solve. So the more problems you can give them to solve in training. And ultimately, I think one of the... I mean, I guess to the second question that you asked about how do you bring young players through and everything else is when you... Leinster is a real advantage, I think, because we have a cohesive team of players who've been together for a long period of time. Some of them played school together. But in some ways, we actually have an uncohesive team because every team we put out every week is different. We've got a lot of players leave for Ireland and et cetera, et cetera. So we constantly change. I change always change the teams in training with a leaning towards the team that's playing at the weekend so they get slots together. The young players are always actively involved from the very start they walk into the room. Now, what happens often with the young players is that, well, listen, you just stand and be this second choice player here and you just stand and hold the bag and you just stand and don't say anything in the meeting and you don't make any decisions in this training field. And if you do make a decision, then all the senior players will shout at you and I'll shout at you as a coach. That is the wrong strategy for developing one, player development, two, cohesion and three, confidence in young players. So that's definitely a big part of how we try and operate here.
I think it keeps the freshness as well. I think that anybody who's watched the team over the last couple of years realises that you know, you must be working with 45 players. You must know about them. You must know their skill set.
It's 65, really. I mean, because it's 45 senior players and 20 academy.
Right.
And on any given day, you know, we've coached all 65, and that doesn't include lads who are playing for Ireland 20s and in the sub-academy. And, you know, we try and touch base with them and bring one or two up to let them get involved. And, you know, part of the secret, and this can all lend to the secret of player development is that the academy staff are aligned and are doing things that are in keeping with what you're doing as a senior coach. So, you know, to be in an open plan office where we've got, you know, Kieran, Dennis Leamy, Noah McNamara, these sorts of guys, Hugh Hogan, Trevor, you know, they're all sat there, Simon Broughton, you know, they're all sat there, we're all sat in the same room. They come to all the meetings, they come to the senior team reviews, they watch the training sessions, the principles that we have adopted in the academy, yet they still have their own personality they can put on their own team.
Yeah, and you can see how that builds a coaching structure that's going to be sustainable into the future as well.
And by the way, you've got then incredibly talented players who are constantly coming in the bottom end, challenging middle to senior players. So, you know, I'm watching Schools Cup this week on TV thinking, geez, he's a good player. Yeah. He's a good player. And, you know, if Leinster, irrespective of what happens to me or Leo or anyone else in the future, you know, Leinster need to understand that the model they have is a good one. And it's not rocket science. That's why I don't mind discussing it, because there's lots of other clubs that do the same thing. Exeter are a great example in England. Saracens, you know, you can argue, well, yes, they got Vincent Cock and Will Skelton, but you can't argue also that their academy has been very good as well.
There will come a point where the traffic jam becomes too great, where there are four out halves and four scrum halves and...
Like now.
Four number eights. Yeah. So, like, that's going to be a question that Irish rugby needs to deal with. What's your thoughts on that?
I think let nature take its course. You know, Leinster, there'll be players at Leinster who we can't give opportunities to for ambitious players, and they'll leave and they'll go and play for either other Irish provinces or somewhere else. That's the reality. You know, I do think identity is an important part of a team, and I do think, you know, to hold on to an identity is critical. I think in any high performing team, Munster have got an incredibly strong identity. Connacht have, Ulster have. That's the strength of Ireland rugby, I think. You know, I think to try and equalise identity, you know, to try and say, well, actually, identity is not important. Let's try and equalise the talent. I don't see that. You know, lads who are born and bred in Leinster and Dublin and, you know, come here, they want to put a blue shirt on. In the same way that lads in Munster, you know, they want to put a red shirt on.
So if there was a system where players were drafted out or whatever, you know, these conversations are happening in the ether, and the main risk, as you would see it, would be the dilution of the rivalries.
The dilution of identity. And I think, you know, identity in a team, you know, is critical. You know, you have to play for a cause. You have to play for something and someone and some area or some province, you know. I think you dilute the identity of the team, of any team, if you were to do that. And it's not the only thing that makes a team, but if I look at teams in England by comparison, you know, London Irish, for example, they've got some good young players come through the academy, but a lot of their players are overseas or not from the catchment area of London Irish. And, you know, I compare that to, say, Leinster, where 95% of our talent is from Leinster. Mm. And then you throw in, you know, a Scott Fardy and a James Lowe and one or two others. That's the model. And I wouldn't just say it because I'm at Leinster. I'd say it for any. You know, it's the model I was trying to promote when I was the academy manager at England. You know, let's build from within. Let's build our own academies. And let's have homegrown talent coming through. And then let's supplement that with quality overseas players who can help that homegrown talent shine.
Yeah, and the identity issue kind of goes back to you need to want to defend, and it's kind of easier
to defend for something. Yeah, exactly. And I think it's also true for me as a coach. You know, I have to live here and buy into the identity and feel part of it. Otherwise, it's false.
Yeah, and people see through that really quickly.
Yeah, well, players do.
And but you wouldn't stay, like you get bored of that. Yeah. Can we talk about the World Cup and the trends? What happened in the World Cup? What, like, previous World Cups have had a massive impact on the global game in the aftermath as everybody tried to do what the team who were successful in the World Cup did. This doesn't feel like one of those World Cups, was it?
No, I don't. I agree with you. I think I've felt for a while that there's been a growth of the game and a knowledge in the game in the Northern Hemisphere that I'm not sure the Southern Hemisphere really appreciated, particularly on defence. So the knowledge of the game and the quality of the coaching on defence and the importance of defence grows in the Northern Hemisphere. So as a consequence, when you're an attack coach in the Northern Hemisphere, you have to think, how are we going to break down these really organised defences now? I'm not sure the same philosophy happened in the Southern Hemisphere in the same way. So when you watch Super Rugby games, you'd see Super Rugby games go, oh my God, this is unbelievable attacking rugby. And I remember doing this presentation, and this was back in 2016, after I'd finished with England. I went to New Zealand, and I did a coach development session, and I did an analysis of an attack of a Super Rugby game. And I talked about, you know, the running lines and the quality of the tries. I think it was something like 54, 35, something. And then I said, right, let's watch this again. But now let's watch it from the team that's defending. And I must have pulled apart like 101 different things that weren't correct and made it easy for the attacking team to score. And the coaches looked at me like I was like daft, really. Because it's just not talked about or thought about. Even when I went to coach the Counties Manukau. And I remember a job came up. One of the Super Rugby jobs came up. And I was out of work. And I thought, yeah, I'd love to at least have an interview. And I didn't get one. And I spoke to the guy, the head of high performance, who wasn't just him that made the decision, but he was part of the decision making. He said, "Well, we promote from within, and you know we're always going to appoint a Kiwi coach into a Kiwi job." And I said, "Do you not think that if you always have that mentality, you're going to miss out potentially on things that are happening outside of your area? You know, this example of diversity in coaching teams." I think it's a really important point. You know, the book Matthew Syed wrote is on diversity. And have you read it?
Which one?
Diversity. No. It's his latest one. And it came about because he and I and Dave Brailson, one or two others, were asked to go on the technical advisory role for the Football Association. So England football, you know, struggling to, you know, improve and bring results. So they created a technical advisory board from people from outside of their sport. And we had these various meetings, and you know, we're still on it now. And Matthew Syed came in as well, and we all brought our ideas. And you know, you could see the Football Association thinking, actually, that makes sense. Or so they really opened up their mind to bringing people in from different sports. So Matthew Syed wrote the book Diversity. My point is, Leinster have diversity. Myself from England, Felipe from Argentina, Robin from Wales, Leo from Leinster, etc., etc. In New Zealand, you know, I feel one of the trends that was beginning to emerge that actually happened was that the defensive development of the Northern Hemisphere and the subsequent attacking, and I'm leaning towards the Lions in 2017, I'm leaning towards England's performance against New Zealand, how England beat Australia as well, and why some of the Southern Hemisphere teams were taken apart because of their defensive systems, and also they were unused to playing against Northern Hemisphere defences themselves. same way that the Lions, I think, shocked people in New Zealand because of the way they defended. So I think that was a trend that was coming that ultimately happened. So, you know, the people who would you perceive as favourites in New Zealand didn't win, which was probably the shock, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, totally.
South Africa won on the back of physicality and defence, and ultimately they've got magical players in like Faf de Klerk, Colby, etc. And ultimately their defence forced England to play a game that had worked against New Zealand, but didn't work. Because why was that? Because part of it, I would say, is because Razi Rasmus coached at Munster. Jacques Nimba, yeah. He was the defence coach at Munster. He learned a lot from that experience.
Yeah, yeah.
Felix Jones going in there. You know, so that's the trend bit, I think, that really came home to roost in the final. I think the cancellation of some games did affect not the integrity, but I think it did change some of the results that might have happened. I think, you know, yeah, to miss out on certain games for certain teams, for Wales to have to play and England not to have to play, or you know, it just yeah, that definitely had a bearing as well, I think.
Yeah, tournaments are supposed to be equal for everybody.
Yeah, and it wasn't, it clearly.
Yeah, exactly. When the dust settled from an Ireland perspective, was you talked about the performance clock before. Was that Ireland team just too late? And was it midnight on the performance clock for us? What happened?
Well, I think you'd have to rewind the clock back to 2018, 2019. You know, so 2018, Grand Slam, amazing. 2019, not quite the same level. And I don't know because I wasn't there. So, you know, the last thing I want to do is criticise Joe, because Joe is someone who I've learnt a huge amount from, both directly and indirectly, coaching against him, coaching here at Leinster, and, you know, his fingerprints are still all over this team. But the 2019 Six Nations, I wonder how well that was reviewed and the lessons learnt in the lead up to the camp, the warm-up games. You know, probably the big red flag for me was the performance at Twickenham in the warm-up game against England. Mm. I mean, there was players I'm watching who are Leinster players, and I'm thinking, geez, we are undercooked here, we're behind the eight ball. And it's very hard to catch up, I think, from that point. England steamrolled it into the warm-up games. It's something I learnt a lot, you know, in 2015, you know, you think back what you've done differently, and, you know, we had three warm-up games. I remember meeting Eddie Jones afterwards, and I said, if I'd have four warm-up games, I'd announce the squad early, which he did.
Yeah.
I'd get the cohesion. Because I think the World Cup is it's geared towards the Southern Hemisphere being successful, because they come at the back of their season, they come on the back of the Rugby Championship, they come on the back of et cetera, et cetera. In the Northern Hemisphere, we have a break, we have the off-season, we have a pre-season, we have three warm-up games or four warm-up games, and then suddenly, bang, you're into the... You've got to be... You know, who plays their best game, first game of the season?
Yeah.
You know, do Dublin do that? Do Leinster do that? Not really.
No.
So you have to hit the ground running, and how you approach those warm-up games and how you prepare your team to deliver in those warm-up games. You know, I felt in 2015, our warm-up games were okay, actually. We beat France, we lost against France, then we beat Ireland, we beat Fiji in the first game. We got a 4-try bonus, which no other team managed to do, but on the day we lost against Wales. What would I have done differently? I'd have had another warm-up game, and I probably would have gone with more of a cohesive team. And I wonder, looking back, you know, whether they would go, what do we need to review more the Six Nations, and do we need to get the planning right in the lead-up to the tournament? Because the Scotland game went well, but it can't just be about the Scotland game, because suddenly the Japan game was the one that killed them.
Yeah. Yeah, and look, we've kind of parsed that Japan game quite a lot on this station. Have you spoken to Joe Schmidt since? Like, would you have any career advice, having been through a difficult World Cup cycle and, like, coming out the other side? And would there be something specific that you would have said?
Funnily enough, I saw him for the first time at the Wales game. So I had a good chat with him then, and hopefully we'll have a catch up and we'll compare notes, I think, because we've both been through the same pain now. So, you know, I'm sure he'll emerge a better coach from the experience. I've spoke to Andy, obviously, met Andy a couple of times. Mike Catt's been here, obviously, I've spoke to him. So there's always lessons to be learned, you know, in defeat and victory. And I think that's the key thing as a coach. You know, I go back to say, like, we lose against Saracens. The easy thing to do is to park it. The easy thing to do is go, you know, that's just too painful to talk about. We've actually got Munster on Saturday in the semi-final of the Pro 14. Let's just park that. But we don't do that. We make them go through the view, go through the learning. And yes, it is personal sometimes, but, you know, I try and protect the personalities by seeing them individually beforehand and talking and meeting them. And
this is going to be difficult.
This is going to be difficult, but we need to be on the same page. I need to explain my point of view. What's your point of view? Let's talk it out. You know, you're a senior player. I'm not going to certainly hang out to dry in a team meeting when it's so difficult when they've, you know, I don't think people can understand how difficult it is for a player, you know, to, if you can stand in the tunnel before an international game or a top end, you know, European Cup final, and there's lots of 15 players lined up side by side with a stadium full of 80,000 people, and you know that there's X million people watching at home, and you're playing for your country and the expectations of a nation, and if on your head could be an error or a mistake that costs you the game. I admire anyone that's prepared to do that, do you know what I mean? So the last thing you're going to do is hold people, you know, to account and hang them out to dry, you know. But you have to do it respectfully, but equally you have to do it, because if you don't learn, then you're going to keep making the same mistakes.
It was kind of pointless, yeah. On the Andy Farrell and Mike Catt, are you seeing stuff in that team now in the first two games that looks familiar to what Leinster do? Because there's definitely been that conversation that they're borrowing a bit of your stuff when they're playing with Ireland at the moment.
Well, I don't think it's that. I mean, I think they're very much, they've got their own philosophies. I made the point, I think, a few weeks ago when I was asked the same question. There'll be similarities, and there's obviously similarities, because I've learned as much from them, you know, during their time with England. And we were successful in a lot of ways in the way in which we attacked and the way in which we defended. So, you know, it's as much me learning from them, bringing it to Leinster, and them taking it back again, as well as the other way around.
So it's a carousel.
I think there's a bit of that. I think there's a bit of that. I think, obviously, you know, Mike would have learnt stuff in the 4 years he's been with Italy. Andy would have learnt a huge amount for 4 years with Joe. And so they'll be doing it their way. Simon Eastby, John Fogarty will have their view. Simon's doing defence, you know, so it looks similar to Leinster, but it won't all be the same. But I don't mind that. You know, I mean, it's whatever. You know, I want.
Just don't reveal any secrets. That's the.
Well, you want your players who you coach to be successful to play for Ireland. I want Ireland to be successful because I know a lot of the people, and I'm invested obviously in the country, and you want them to do well. So, and I know what it feels like when you don't do well, and you won't wish that on anyone.
Yeah.
You know, really. It's. I think people were a bit negative after the Scotland performance. I think people didn't understand the change in defensive policy from Scotland. That was the thing that really I was frustrated with in the narrative, where I was like, yeah, but Steve Tandy's coaching defence now. It's not Matt Taylor. Matt Taylor has, you know, 12 in the front line, one in the middle, two in the backfield. You know, he's got returning guys all over the place. So I'm not saying Matt Taylor's defensive system wrong. It's geared to a counter-attack, but it makes you vulnerable. So Scotland then become vulnerable defensively. Suddenly Steve Tandy comes in, who's from Ospreys, been coaching the Waratahs, coached with Brad Davis, 13-2, 14-1. Ireland have suddenly got to try and break down a well-organised Scottish defensive team. Scotland have always been good on attack. It's the first game for Andy and Mike. They've had three or four training sessions, and they won. And then suddenly everyone's like, oh, well, it's the same. I'm like, geez, cool, give him a break.
Yeah.
For God's sake. And then the interesting thing about Wales for me was, so Wales changed their coaching team. So the Wales coaching team, and now the Scarlets coaching team, who obviously Leinster have played against. So you've got Byron Hayward coaching defence there. You've got Stephen Jones doing attack. You've got Wayne Pivac as the head coach. And a lot of times, the noise comes to the head coach. It's Pivac. I think, well, who's the assistant coaches? Who are the ones actually doing the coaching on the field? Mm. They're the ones you need to know about. First 5 minutes of that Ireland game against Wales, I'm thinking, Ireland will win this. I could see how tight Wales were defensively. I could see, I mean, they were a great example of a team committing numbers to the breakdown. And yes, it was high risk, high reward, but they didn't get much reward because Ireland's accuracy at the breakdown was good. So they retained the ball, but suddenly their defensive line's getting narrower and the space on the edges, and Ireland have worked hard on their shape, unstructured shape off the ball, and suddenly you've got Stockdale run down one wing and Conway another wing.
Yeah.
And Ireland thoroughly deserve to win. Now, completely different challenge again now going to Twickenham, because you've got, you know, John Mitchell defence, you've got a new guy, Simon Amor, Sevens coach, coming in as the attack. You've got not a lot of footage to go on because the Scotland game was like a washout, literally. France obviously beat England. So what England team will turn up, I'm not sure, if I'm being honest. Obviously, I know a lot of the players, and I know this is a team that got to a World Cup final, and on any given day, they can 100% turn up. But Ireland have got a real chance, I think. And if Ireland can get a win at Twickenham, you then talk about Italy at home, and then you talk about France away, and I think Ireland can beat France away.
That wouldn't be a bad start.
We'll be able to start for a Six Nations campaign, wouldn't it, for a new coach? And, you know, I'll be there, you know, probably having a beer with him at some point.
There was one last thing I wanted to ask you about. Kieran Shannon wrote a great piece in The Examiner at the start of the year about a coaching seminar, and he said you gave a masterclass in DCU. He talked about you having a relationship with Jim Gavin, and I was interested in just asking about that. How did that come about? What kind of conversations did you have with Jim when he was the Dublin manager?
Oh, no, it was very, very, when I say a relationship, you know, it's a relationship born on the fact that Leo invited him in, and he gave a presentation to the coaching team. I think Leo's been into the Dublin coaching sessions. And Jim and I desperately tried to meet on various different occasions, but he's a pretty busy man, and I was like either flying back to Leeds and he's literally flying somewhere else. So we never actually met. So, that was one tiny, tiny segment that I mentioned. I certainly can't have any... I can't say that's been a big part of... I've watched out of interest. I'm getting to grips with the sport more, so I understand the sport more. I certainly understand him more. One of the guys who works for us works for the Dublin team as well, so it's interesting when you speak to him about his comparison between the two environments.
Yeah.
Obviously, they've tried to win and successfully did five in a row, and we're trying to win the European Cup five times. So there are some similarities, but no, I can't say I know Jim well enough to be able to say.
Is the interest in people coming here to present to you guys about what their experience of high performance is? Like, why, for example, would Jim come and present to you guys?
I think because Leo asked him, because Leo's very open-minded and he wants to learn from the best. And clearly, if you've got someone on your doorstep who's elite, not just an elite coach, but an elite leader, an elite developer of teams, why wouldn't you ask the guy who's on the doorstep to come in and speak to you? So, you know, that's where it comes from. But equally, I think we've all got a very strong growth mindset here, you know, where we check and challenge each other all the time. And that starts from the top. And again, that reiterate the point, that starts from Leo. So he, you know, he would, what do you think? He'd constantly, every Monday morning we'll come in and go, right, what do you think about the games of the weekend? Not just our game, what do you think about this, 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 and this? I'll regularly present to the players examples of Six Nations games or Super Rugby games or Rugby League games or anything that I think can generate an interest. And I'm trying to get the players also to do that more often, because young players now, if you ask them what's the difference, they don't watch as much rugby or as much sport as perhaps we do.
Mm.
Certainly you, anyway, you probably watch more than anyone I know, but they've got so many other things they can watch. And I think we can really grow that side of players' development by understanding not just the game, games in general. More so, so when you've got an elite coach, an elite team sat on your doorstep, it'd be stupid not to bring them in.
It's clearly not the only time you've been at DCU. You just mentioned you were at another presentation there recently. So you feel like you need to give back to the coaching community as well. That's where you come from. That's kind of, they're your people. That's your church.
Yeah. I think probably in leadership and coaching, I do care about passing what I've learned, because I believe, you know, I've learned so much from so many great coaches, some of whom never even knew I existed. You know, I'm reading the John Wooden book or a Bill Walsh book, and I'm inspired. I want to be a better coach. And I think, you know, if I said, when I rang you yesterday to discuss this, I said, you know, what would be the end game? The end game would be, if I'm a hockey coach or a soccer coach or a GA coach or whatever, I've come away with that from that interview, having learned even what's one nugget, one thing that's made me reflect and think I can be a better coach. Because ultimately, coaching is teaching. It's teaching people to improve, to get better. And if you supplement good coaching with good leadership, and you've got a good management structure around it, then you're going to have a good high-performance organisation. And it's rewarding, to be honest. When you give stuff away and people appreciate it, you don't expect anything back in return, but it's nice to have the appreciation, because that's it. That's what you want to achieve.
And the other thing is that your life is so bound up in results that you probably need some satisfaction outside of results as well.
Yeah. And I guess because my family live in Leeds, you know, I've got a bit of time on my hands, and I try and use that time profitably rather than sit at home and put Netflix on. So yeah. I'd rather share. So yeah, I've got, like, you've probably seen the stuff on LinkedIn, give a lot of stuff away on LinkedIn, and people appreciate it.
Well, listen, best of luck with the rest of the season. I think there's plenty of nuggets in that. Thanks a million.
Cheers. Rugby on Off the Ball. With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us, everyone in.